And welcome to our podcast on Bangladesh and international law. Thank you, Shahab, for joining us today. And let me begin with congratulating you on the publication of such a brilliant book with such a remarkable lineup of speakers and topics. And I really wanted to say, actually, before we go ahead, how much I like the acronym BAIL, Bangladesh and International Law, because I thought, what a neat acronym and what a signifier of the growing recognition of the importance of peering behind traditional actors in international law and the importance of untangling complex relationships between international law on one hand and its lived realities and histories in the global south on the other. So most of the contributions in the book have been written by established scholars that are known for their scholarship in the fields such as TWAIL, Third World Approaches to International Law. So in some ways, it is almost unsurprising that the book such as this was penned by you and your collaborators at this particular time. But I wanted to ask you, what was the impetus for the project? Was there any specific event or an occasion that prompted you to conceive this edited collection?
Thank you very much, Mavluda. So first of all, thanks to you for taking the trouble of putting together this wonderful podcast and giving some airtime to our book, Bangladesh and International Law. And my sincerest thanks also to Asian Society of International Law for doing this. Now, coming back to your question, motivation, we had a number of actually quite powerful motivations, especially as the editor. I was primarily driven by one factor. So this year, 2021, is the 50th anniversary of the independence of Bangladesh. So Bangladesh got independence back in 1971 following a long war against Pakistan. So it was an important moment, an occasion for us to look back and to think and examine to what extent Bangladesh engaged and encountered international law in a wide range of ways. So the one of the main motivations behind this edited volume was to document this state practice, the way Bangladesh engaged with international law, in the process Bangladesh contributed to the making of international law, and to what extent Bangladesh, like many post-colonial states, suffered from international law, to document it. At the same time, another motivation was to do some sort of community building, to use this as an opportunity to bring together Bangladesh international lawyers from not only from Bangladesh, but also from elsewhere who are based in other countries like me. So as you rightly said, some of the contributors are really senior established academics, but it is also true that a significant part of a number of our contributors are actually based in Global South who are based in Bangladesh, who are early career researchers. So it's a unique combination of very senior, mid-career, and very young Bangladesh international lawyers. It's a collaborative effort. But there is also another important motivation which touches upon some of the normative aspects. So from this part of the world, from the Global North, we often tend to think that we know the Global South. And many of our scholarship is driven by that assumption that we know. So this book was also an opportunity to listen from the scholars who are in the Global South, to hear from them their own experience being based there, being working there, their own experience and engagement with international law. So I think in that sense, the book also offers a good opportunity to hear their voice and to for us to reflect on their understanding of international law. And I thought that was also a very important aspect of this volume.
Well, thank you. As obviously Bangladesh and international law is a highly timely scholarly project, as I said earlier, not least because Bangladesh has been at the center of the global attention due to the salience of climate change issues, the Rohingya refugees crisis, labor rights in the ready-made garment sector, and the prosecution of war crimes. And a number of chapters in the book focus on these issues. through the prism of state and its others. Could you tell us more as to what are the mechanisms through which you believe international law has its othering effect by marginalizing certain individuals and groups? And importantly, what do you think can be done to reverse or even stop such effects of international law?
Thank you. I think this is an extremely important question, Mavluda. So one of the main, so just to give you the background, so one of the most important themes that we wanted to grasp in this book is to understand international law, not only in a conventional way, not only as a problem-solving tool, but also to what extent international law is very much a facilitator of that problem. But also at the same time, we are very much mindful of the emancipatory potential of international law, to what extent international law can help. So in many chapters, you will find that both themes are working hand in hand. So one of the important areas where we see the role of international law when it comes to the othering impact of the post-colonial state itself is this liberal ideology that offered a template not only to Bangladesh, but also to many other countries in the global south, the kind of liberal template, often in the name of human rights, that will fix the problems in many ways, especially in relation to equal citizenship, which are all good. The doctrines of equality, non-discrimination, all good. But in this book, we came up with a list of various other cultural groups who are rather marginalized via these roots of equality and non-discrimination. So this is one of the very important areas where international law plays a key role, especially when it comes to ethnic minorities or indigenous people who are always outside this core of the state-making process, and the notions of equality and non-discrimination do not really help them much. The other othering factor would be the developmental ideology. How in the name of economic development, and when we talk about economic development, we understand development in a very particular way, in a neoliberal way. So that kind of developmentalism has disenfranchised a good number of people, not only the poor, but also, as I mentioned, various ethnic and minorities and indigenous communities, because they are the ones who are, given that they're politically less powerful, they are already politically marginalized. So they have the less bargaining capacity when it comes to developmental hegemony and developmental atrocities. So most often they're the people who has to sacrifice their land. They're the victims of land grabbing in the name of development.
Thank you. I did think that kind of the case study approach in particular was one of the fascinating features of this edited collection. It actually takes me neatly to the next question that I wanted to ask. When reading the book, I thought that many of the arguments put forward in its different chapters can be neatly captured in the words of a B.S. Chimney you cite in the introduction. I quote, "While contemporary international law is imperial in character, the possibility and benefits of reform should not be ruled out through the struggles of subaltern groups, peoples, and nations." I really share this view and certainly see that potential in the field where my own research interests lie, that is international economic law. So I wanted to ask, as an editor, as well as one of the contributing authors of the book, can you share your thoughts as to the concrete areas and issues where international law, despite its imperial legacies, presents the possibility of the reform to benefit post-colonial states such as Bangladesh, but also other states, communities and groups in the global south?
Absolutely. And I think going back to the main point, that one of the key themes of this book is covers both aspects of international law. So your question specifically leads me to think about, for example, human rights. So in the state and the and its others section, where we have a good number of chapters to showcase the hegemonic nature of the state itself and the role international law plays. But at the same time, some of the responses that various authors put forward are very much reliant upon other aspects of international law. So human rights, for example, would be a classic example here. So we all critical international lawyers now know about the imperial nature of human rights to some extent. a good number of critical international lawyers have written about that. But at the same time, when it comes to the Global South, when you have police brutalities, not telling them or just telling them that human rights is an imperial tool is not going to help the situation. So there we rely on the emancipatory project of international law. And to go back to the specific quote from B.S. Chimney, not to lose hope, rather to explore various avenues through which international law can be used in a pro-people, pro-poor, pro-marginalized communities way. And it is emancipation in both ways. So you think about applying international law to the betterment of people, the most marginalized people, but at the same time, it is an emancipation of international law itself. So human rights is definitely one. In the chapter on climate justice, authors talked about various ways in which Bangladesh and countries like Bangladesh, who are the victims of climate change without much fault of their own, can use various international law mechanism to achieve and secure justice. International trade in relation to ready-made garments, which is a very problematic area, international trade, given its extreme bias in favor of the powerful countries. But countries like Bangladesh benefited to some extent in the RMG sector or in the pharmaceutical sector. So there is a good chapter on what will happen with the transition to middle-income country sooner. Using these concrete examples, the themes that actually emerge as a result is a theme of Bangladesh's participation in the international system, Bangladesh's contribution to the international system, and also there is a very important aspect of global solidarity among countries like Bangladesh. So Bangladesh has been one of the powerful speakers for racial justice globally during the South African apartheid regime. So these are some of the very concrete areas where international law definitely has some promise. But the question is to what extent we can nurture international law and international law thinking towards that emancipatory move. That would be the challenge for everyone, for all international lawyers, and when it comes to states like Bangladesh, for everyone.
That's really fascinating. If I could just make a post out of those words, participation, contribution, and solidarity, just to remind us about what Project of International Law is, and not just the critical questions it poses in front of us, but also the challenges where we could look into its, as you say, emancipatory potential. And this is, again, links me to another question that I wanted to ask, and that's concerning one of the themes that runs through a number of chapters in the book, and which concerns the subject matter very close to my heart, something that continues to challenge my thinking to date. That's the issue of capacity building, institutional reforms, and their role in enabling or at times preventing the emergence of nationally felt approaches of a nationally grounded voice on one or another set of challenges faced by post-colonial states as well as the global community as a whole. In your view, does capacity building too represent yet another form of exporting Western norms? And this is something that you're thinking in the book on, for example, development projects and so on, seems to be reflected. So are there possibilities for capacity building to carry emancipatory effect that we've been just talking about, and emancipatory effect in particular in relation to the making and implementation of international law and the ability of countries such as Bangladesh as well as others to participate, to contribute, and to express their solidarity in meaningful ways?
Absolutely. And I think this is a very, very important question that you have raised, Mafruda. So thank you. So my quick response to that question is going to be no, not in the current form. This current form of capacity building, which are often exported globally, is not going to do much good. And there's a good reason for that, because this very thinking is colonial in its character. The whole idea that we know, in the global north, we know we have the technical know-how about how to fix the problem of the global south, is all about capacity building. And this particular thinking about capacity building actually hides structural injustices. which are in many cases the very creation of that international economic system. So keeping that structural injustice or the system that facilitates that sort of injustice, economic exploitation and everything, keeping that on the one hand, and then talking about capacity building on the other, is not going to make much difference in a way that would actually have a kind of ideological impact on justifying the or glossing over the structural injustice itself. Having said that, as someone who spent significant part of his life in the Global South itself, in Bangladesh in my case, as a student, as an academic, I cannot deny the importance of building local capacity. Because if you have to deliver, you have to develop the capacity to deliver in the way that helps people. We know about corruption and all sorts of stories. In many cases, we know that those issues have been facilitated by international actions and activities. Having said all that, no one can deny the question about creating a system, an efficient system that can deliver for the poor, that can deliver for the marginalized. So there is no question about the importance, sorry, no denial of this importance of capacity building. So perhaps the response to your question is the how part, how to do it. I think that is the bottom line. So the most important way forward in that regard would be to listen to local people and to stop thinking that we know in the Global South or international financial institutions that somehow we know. Because this very assumption of knowing is very colonial. At the core of colonialism is this idea that some people are not simply capable of governing their own affairs, right? So this is at the very core of this colonial mindset. So that justifies the idea that these people are always in need of some sort of external expertise, which always remains in the Global North, in the West. We have to break with that idea. We have to listen to the people who are in charge in the Global South, who can make much more efficient change, who can be much more efficient actors of change. So it is more about creating an enabling condition in which local communities can develop their own skill set. They can come together and put forward reform agendas in a way that works for them, not for any other external vicious economic agenda. I think that is the way forward. And that sort of capacity building is essential. Without that, Global South countries cannot really move forward. So we have to do it, but in a very particular way.
Yes, I really agree with all of what you just said, because this is exactly what my own thinking is at the moment, even though, as I said, that the whole idea of capacity building continues to bedevil me as a scholar. I believe that it is indeed something that needs to be done. It's just how we do it, but also how we talk about it and how we research it and how we conceptualize and problematize it, that also matters a lot. So beyond the usual suspects, that is TWAIL scholars, critical legal scholars and their ilk, who are your intended readers? Who are the intended readers of this exceptional book? If you were to pitch the book to someone outside your own epistemic communities, what would you say?
That is a challenging question. So perhaps my pitch would be in this line, that of course it is a book on international law. It is written by international lawyers and it deals with a number of international law issues. But at the end of the day, I, as the editor, also conceived this book as a collection of stories, as a collection of international law stories of sufferings, solidarity, resistance, and resilience. Anyone who is interested in Global South, anyone who has any appetite to listen to those stories told by people who lived that experience should be interested in this book, because at the end of the day, it is a collection of stories told by a group of scholars from the Global South. So that would be my appeal to wider audience, if they're interested.
I hope the book will attract as many readers as it truly deserves. And congratulations again on this book. And thank you for taking time to talking about this very important project. And we'll look forward to other conversations on the subject. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mavluda. And thanks also to Asian Society of International Law for hosting me and giving us, the community of Bangladesh International Lawyers, this platform. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shahab.